Welcome back. Remember, if you bought a house anywhere but Santa Barbara, you didn't pay enough. Unless maybe you bought a house or a condo or a co-op in New York City. And that's where today's guest hails from, live from New York, Professor Matthew Lasner, professor at Hunter College in New York City, professor of urban affairs and planning. He wrote a book recently called High Life, Condo Living in the Suburban Century. He earned a PhD and AM in architecture, landscape architecture, and urban planning at Harvard, and holds an MS in urban and regional planning studies from the London School of Economics. And he attended Columbia, got his BA in urban studies. Welcome to Radio Real Estate, Professor Lasner.
Thank you very much.
I like your photo in that little bio. You look like a professor. You got the glasses and the books right in the background, so we can't mistake you.
We've got to play the part.
Right, exactly, exactly. We can't see your ponytail, probably, that's in the back. So thank you so much for joining us. I read an article that was entitled Chronicling How U.S. Condo Ownership Went Through the Roof, and it was written by Mary Umberger on March 1st, 2013, March 1st, and it talks about your book, and it just got me thinking. I'm from New York originally, grew up in Mount Vernon, New York. Are you familiar with that?
Sure.
Yeah? And grew up in an apartment, four-story walk-up. So I thought it'd be interesting to have you discuss the history of the condominium, and of course it morphs into many other issues as well, multiple ownerships, how it solved different issues for folks. But maybe before we jump into the history of the condo, you talk about three forms of ownership, and maybe you could define them, and then we'll describe which evolved first, but condo, co-op, and own your own, which is something that I've never really dealt with out here.
And it's even from your neck of the woods, from Southern California. Sure, that's a great place to begin. The thing about co-ownership, I mean, the thing about any kind of ownership, and if we have any lawyers in the audience who studied property law in law school, typically ownership is described as a bundle of sticks, and different forms of ownership include different rights in property. And that bundle may change over time. You know, government can change it. By custom, it can change. Co-ownership is sort of an array of different bundles. And the most common forms of co-ownership are condo, co-op, and this archaic form we don't use any longer, which you mentioned, own your own. But I like to emphasize that they're all sort of shades of gray that are used to ultimately achieve the same end, which is ownership of a unit in a multiple family complex. Today, the most common of these is, today the most common is condominium. I should start with the co-op, though, because historically that was a predominant form in the U.S. Going back to the late 19th century, when you first start to see the introduction of middle-class apartment living. This was not working-class tenements had been around and chopping up old houses to make rent. But it's not until around the time of the Civil War that you start to see kind of planned, purpose-built apartment buildings for a middle-class or even an upper-class clientele, and they appear first in Boston, New York, you know, other kind of eastern city, big city centers.
High density.
Yeah.
City. And you use the term tenement, which in the way you used it didn't have any pejorative connotation, but yet I think today, for some reason, people look at that as having a negative connotation.
Sure, sure. And the word itself has a negative connotation. And by tenement, I really just mean, you know, sort of a working class multifamily dwelling, you know, some of which are the kind of typical New York six-story walk-up buildings with the fire escapes that were, you know, built specifically to house poor families. Others were old row houses or even single family houses that got chopped up by tenants and landlords and became overcrowded and unhealthful. So certainly in the 19th century, any kind of multifamily living had that taint, the taint of the tenement, and was considered sort of a lower class way of living to be avoided. So middle class families are living in houses or row houses. in the mid 19th century, but that's starting to change as cities grow up. Some people are starting to pioneer the first suburbs. Other families are getting together and building upwards and starting to pioneer these apartment houses, which were actually called French flats at first. The idea, they were modeled on sort of high-class buildings from Paris that were being built. And the term itself, apartment or French flat, meant to distinguish these places from working-class tenements. These were respectable places to live.
Was France and parts of Europe ahead of us on the density apartment-type living?
Definitely. Definitely. Not England so much, but Scotland and continental Europe certainly were. And there are a whole bunch of reasons for that. One very simple reason is that European cities were walled for centuries, and the walls came down in the 19th century as they grew. But there had been this kind of longer tradition of people living at higher densities. Another issue in Europe is that you have an inherited aristocracy there. So it never seemed sort of de classe for a rich person to live at higher densities because everyone knew his place, whether you were born rich or born poor. In America, we never had that, so there's a little more anxiety about these new forms that could be interpreted the wrong way.
My guest, Professor Matthew Lasner, he's at Hunter College. He's a professor of urban affairs and planning, and his recent book, High Life Condo Living in the Suburban Century. You know, as you're talking, Matthew, it kind of makes me feel like you're a good guest for a real estate-based program like myself, but you'd also be a great guest for a program based on sociology and psychology, because I can hear you keep referencing the implications of what's going on with housing.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to think about housing not just as a real estate product or as an architectural design, but also as representing a kind of social group. And I'm sure your listeners who are thinking more about real estate today and the future of the house or the condo or the putt or what have you, recognize that this is a really important market right now because of the aging of baby boomers. You know, so it really it's impossible to talk about housing without thinking about not just how it's financed and what it looks like, but who's going to live there, who your client is.
And the amazing swing, the way you described from the Civil War years, 1860s, and tenements and breaking up mansions into separate units and getting people in there and building for poor people in the heart of the city. And the swing just came to mind where now in Santa Barbara, for example, where these condos have gone up and they're very, very expensive. And there's one being built right now that's going to include the concierge and a rooftop garden and just attracting people, you know, at the very top of the pay scale. And mm-hmm. So quite a big swing.
Yeah, and we see the seeds of that at this moment, where you see a handful of well-to-do families in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s looking to Europe and thinking that this might be an appealing way to live. You know, you could have fewer servants, you could share the cost of land, more families could live in an appealing location. I assume in Santa Barbara we're talking about, I don't know, beachfront locations or some other choice location. In New York, it was Fifth Avenue. The very first luxury buildings we see go up around Gramercy Park and around Central Park and places that were very appealing then and are appealing now. And the lineage, you know, the sort of earliest experiments in kind of multi-family housing for well-to-do families, even before the apartment, were in luxury hotels. It was not uncommon to find families not just staying for a night in a hotel, but living for a whole season or year-round basis in fancy hotels. And as enough of them did this, the idea of building an actual apartment house emerged. And which brings us to the co-op. It was only a matter of, you know, after a very few short years, you know, people who had a lot of resources who wanted to experiment this way thought, why do this on a rental basis when we can own and have greater control over the community and a say in how the building is run and even kind of minimize our expenses.
I like that, and I like your mentioning that the wealthy families putting in these type of density apartment units on Fifth Avenue, Central Park. We have very little oceanfront property that would be available to build these types. So we're similar. You know, our Central Park and Fifth Avenue is State Street, and that's where the core, the downtown of these units are being built here. But I liked you adding the fact that the wealthy families were jumping on board as well, and that helped lead to the co-op. So describe how that sprouted up and what exactly that is.
Sure. Now, we see a handful of early apartment buildings in other cities, but New York is the main center. Manhattan, you know, as is now, is our highest density center. And we see a handful of apartment buildings coming online, and the rents are sky high, and there were complaints that the apartments were too small. And groups of prospective tenants had the idea of doing things better on their own. Paralleling this, we see a French architect by the name of Philip Hubert. He had come over from Paris as a young man. He was actually a self-made man. He was an inventor. He invented a kind of button that he sold to the U.S. Army during the Civil War and made a fortune. And he was tinkering around in New York and thinking about, you know, how to house well-to-do families in Manhattan, and came up with the idea for what he called the Home Club. And the first generation of owned buildings were called the Hubert Home Clubs. And what he would do is he would scout out a piece of land, find a group of prospective tenants. Usually they were friends, sometimes family even, who were interested in becoming homeowners and doing a building together. And they would basically sort of make their down payments to him, and the land would be bought, and he would design the building. And then the apartments in the end were each individually owned. The way that he did this was through what we now call the co-op or the cooperative. And this was a system of corporate title ownership. If you think about a single-family house or a condo, we've got individual titles, an individual title and deed for each parcel, right? Each cube of air in a condo, or each parcel of land in a house.
Yes.
The co-op followed it's obviously we do title searches. There's a lot of legal work involved in kind of creating deeds and splitting up property. As I'm sure developers in your audience know, the co-op was a much simpler way of doing this. It basically maintained title with a single corporate entity. It was based on the model of the corporation, which is becoming more important in American life in the 19th century, and I think also on the club, you know, the city club, the university club, or a country club model of things.
So this is going back into the 1860s? Or a little
going
later.
Back, this is actually Hubert put this plan together in around 1879. Although there had been earlier proposals, even in 1860, there was a proposal for a similar project that didn't go forward.
Now, did we already have corporations as we know them today, and he kind of borrowed from them, or did he actually create this?
No, he's borrowing from corporate. He's using sort of state corporations law as a guideline to structure these. So he's borrowing from this familiar model of the corporation.
But groundbreaking, and basically people move in, and instead of owning, as you mentioned, in single family home, you own you get a deed, and you have you own fee simple, or in a condo you own the airspace within your unit. Here you simply own shares of a corporation that own the entire property. In which led to, at least in Santa Barbara, a lot of banks not loving it and not wanting to loan on them. So we had a few co-ops here that converted to condominiums.
Mm-hmm. That's very common, especially less so in New York City, but everywhere else. It's just a different way of owning. From one perspective, are shares of stock in this corporation. But really, the ownership is conveyed rather than through a deed, through a proprietary lease. This is effectively a long-term perpetual lease granting the owner of shares to occupy and to use a particular portion of the property.
Exclusive,
in
yeah, exclusive use. My guest, a professor from Hunter College, Professor Matthew Lasner of Urban Studies and Planning, and his recent book, High Life, Condo Living in Suburban Century. Matthew, we need to take a commercial break, so can you stay over for one more segment?
Sure.
So we've done the co-op.
We've done the co-op. We haven't gotten very far.
We haven't done... Welcome to my world. And so we'll take a break. Mark Schneiman's Radio Real Estate, RadioRealEstate.com, 452-2428, 452-CHAT. So we'll come back with the professor, and we'll see how the condominium morphed out of the co-op. And if we have time, this Own Your Own, which had maybe a shorter shelf life. And also kind of interesting, you mentioned living in the hotels. Howard Hugh Hefner kind of picked that up again in the 1970s. And but I like the quote that, I don't know if it was you had or this gal had, or some guy who didn't like his living there, because the wife, if she was living in a hotel, she wouldn't do any housework, and they would sit in the lobby and chit-chat.
Yep.
So we had to get the wife back into housework. So they, and then he invented, and Philip Hubert was the hair club for men? the home club, I'm sorry.
The home club.
Okay.
The home club, but that guy who was worried about his wife chit-chatting, he had written about the evils of living in a building, you know, living in an apartment building, and then... When the home club came along, he was one of the first buyers. He lived in the first building and lived there, raised his sons there, lived there for 30 years, died in the building.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back.